This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up, filmmaker Mike Friedman says we've hit critical mass towards extinction by overpopulation. Bill McKibben tells me why everybody in the world needs to battle the tar sands. Council of Canada's founder Maude Barlow links dirty energy to dirty politics. And Native leader Caleb Benn on his fracked land, poisoned lives, and linking up around the world. I'm Alex Smith with a full show. Let's get going.
Back in the 1950s, we heard about some experiments done by a man called Cahoon, in which he put rats into a limited space and then gave them unlimited resources. The rat population started to grow. It reached a point where they could no longer function as rats. Their social structure collapsed. The population was in serious trouble.
To make a bomb, you need critical mass. In the nuclear world, critical mass is the amount of radioactive material required in just the right shape to create a self-sustaining chain reaction and maybe a devastating explosion. Millions of people around the world are wondering if we're heading towards that moment. Filmmaker Mike Friedman set out to document the really big picture, the forces that could culminate in disaster for humanity and most living things. Mike, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Well, you have an earlier short documentary up on Vimeo called Between Two Mirrors, Occupy London. Tell us about that.
Well, while I was in production on Critical Mass, I had a friend staying with me from Australia, Sharon Ead, who also helped us with the interviews on the long doc. And we decided to go down and check out the first day of the Occupy protest in London. I have a little GoPro camera that you can mount on your head. And to my amazement, with the camera mounted on my head, I could just walk around filming. And no one seemed to notice, really, that I was wearing a camera. So I went down, I spoke to some of the police, I spoke to some of the protesters, and then with about 40 minutes of footage, I just chopped it up into a little 8-minute thing that I felt was good enough to make available. In terms of why I chose that name and why I feel that that little 8-minute thing is worth watching, I was struck by the complicity of the protesters in their own enclosure. As I say briefly in that short documentary, there's an element of consent in a protest like that, where the ring of police surrounding the protesters isn't big enough or strong enough to really hold them. So there's a kind of consent to accept the authority that's imposed. And a few people have criticized the police in the UK, and similar allegations have been made against other police forces around the world, of undue brutality in putting down ideological protests like the Occupy movement. And to me, I wanted to make a point that the police at that protest were suffering from exactly the consequences of the perfidy that Occupy were protesting against. And in fact, there's a police officer who says quite clearly that, you know, it's his job to keep the protesters in, whether or not he agrees with them. And the Metropolitan Police Force that were keeping them enclosed were suffering massive, stringent cuts across the board, especially to frontline policing and backroom staff. There are no good and bad people anymore. There's simply people who know what's going on and people who've been misinformed. There's a verse in the Tao, which I use to conclude that short documentary, which is, what is a good man but a bad man's teacher? What is a bad man but a good man's job? And I find it very striking that in what we call the information age, the dividing line in most social or political conflicts is drawn by access to the right information. And so it seemed to me that the protesters were one mirror of our culture, and the police were another. The police would just as easily be facing outwards protecting them if the rules changed ever so slightly, because the police force is a tool, not a weapon. Its deadliness or its passivity is dictated by the hand that wields it. And so I felt that I was between two mirrors, as in both of them essentially neutral, simply reflecting what they were being told. On the one hand, people being told that their futures were going to be bleaker, that we were giving money to the banks that could be better used for social programs, that social programs had to be cut because of quote-unquote necessity. And on the other hand, a mirror showing us that the establishment doesn't respond well to ideological criticism. Time again, you see that plenty of space is given to protests against single issues or protests in favor of a whole wealth of things. But when there really is a resistance and a crackdown from the establishment, it tends to be something like the Occupy movement, which has at its core not an activity, but an ideal. And this always seems very threatening. So that was why I called it Between Two Mirrors. And that was the thinking that led me to put it up on the web for free, in the hope that people would watch it and share it.
Well, we should backtrack then, because you were already on your adventure to grab the big picture, the whole ball of wax. What started you out on that?
Being a filmmaker, I watch a lot of films. You know, if you want to be a writer, you have to read. If you want to make films, you have to watch them. And I'm a big fan of documentary, especially environmental documentary. And I noticed a trend in environmental films that were otherwise well-researched and perfectly competently constructed, that they tended to stop short or skirt around the issue of population. They would discuss the depletion of a resource or the destruction of a natural environment. And if they did mention the role of people in that depletion or destruction, it was usually couched as a consumption issue, as if consumption was the only issue. And it seemed to me that that was either an oversight or disingenuous, or, to give them the credit that they rightly deserve, simply that it's too big of a subject to be tackled as an aside in a documentary focusing on something else. And so my motive for making Critical Mass was that I believe very strongly that the number of humans alive on the planet and the way that number changes the way we think and feel and behave has an intimate relationship with the other environmental crises we see around us, and also itself an intimate relationship with the manner in which and the amount that we consume. And so, wanting to frame that properly in a film, I set out to begin my research. But I didn't want to make a Malthusian dirge telling everyone that people were bad for the planet and that all consumption is terrible and that, you know, there should be less people. That's not what I believe, and it's not what I was hoping to achieve. My goal was to basically recount the human story in a hope that it would point to a deeper understanding of where we stood now.
Well, of course, we got to talk about John Calhoun's rat experiment, which is in your movie trailer for Critical Mass. Talk to us about that. What was he trying to do? Why did he do it? And what does it tell us?
Well, that's exactly the right point to ask that question, Alex, so I thank you. Basically, I came across Calhoun's experiments in my preliminary reading. And once I knew about those experiments, I had my narrative. I had my story that I could tell. And then from that story, on that spine, if you like, I could hang the parallels to the human situation, which is the way that we made the film. Calhoun himself was a, depending on which job title you use, the most common is a research psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health, which itself is very interesting because Calhoun only ever worked with rodents. And so it was very telling that in his early career, he was transferred from, I believe it was Walter Reed, to the National Institute of Mental Health, which deals explicitly with mental health for people. So there was always implied within his work and made explicit by him several times a parallel to human behavior, human society. The way that Calhoun conducted his experiments was very simple. He would construct an enclosure that contained all the necessary food, water, and nesting material for survival. He would place breeding pairs, so male and female rodents, into those enclosures, and he would simply allow them to roam around this Garden of Eden. And slowly they would begin to reproduce, and that reproduction would accelerate. And as this trend continued, he charted the progress of the population's growth and the manner in which the rats' behavior changed over time, both of which bear striking parallels to human behavior and human society as it's developed. It's also worth noting that in terms of knowing what rats were like, Calhoun literally wrote the book on the Norway rat. He wrote a book called The Ecology of the Norway Rat. So this was a man who was intimately acquainted with the behavior of this species in the wild. And so he was uniquely placed to discuss and investigate the way that that species' behavior changed when transplanted from its natural setting to an enclosure that he himself referred to as Rat City. He believed that he was replicating conditions for the rats that we see in human urban environments. And so his work was always meant to be understood as a way, a lens of viewing ourselves and our urban environments and the way in which we interact with one another and how that has changed, how it may change, and how we can preserve those very special and unique bonds that we consider valuable in human society.
But, Mike, is the rat experiment really a good model to predict what will happen to humans on an expanding, expanding on a finite planet? Aren't we more intelligent?
Well, I'll leave the question as to whether we're more intelligent than rats to one side for a moment. I want to make something absolutely clear, which is that I'm not suggesting, and nor did Calhoun suggest, that what the rats did, so shall we do. That is not what he meant. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that all mammals, like rodents and humans, have behavior patterns, some of which are genetic, some of which are learned, some of which are simple, some of which are complex. And those behavior patterns change depending on the social conditions in which we live. Now, it's not to say that what a rat does in an enclosure, a human will do in a city. It is, however, worth considering that there are structural similarities. So rats have a type of society. Humans have a type of society. Rats have certain behaviors. Humans have certain behaviors. And within a dense, stressful, crowded, impersonal milieu, the rats suffered. And I don't necessarily believe it needs to be argued that humans also suffer in dense, stressed, crowded, impersonal milieu. So the parallel is not meant to be direct. It is meant to be, in essence, as I said before, a lens or a metaphor for what we're going through and what we may continue to go through. As for humans being more intelligent, towards the end of the film, I offer an observation, which is that, and I believe this is verbatim because I had to memorize it to record it in the voiceover booth, humans might not be rats, but that doesn't mean we can't learn from what happened to them. It means we have to do better.
The assumptions that 9 billion people on the planet by 2050 would not be a problem are generally predicated on the assumption that we can continue to increase agricultural yields. And the way agricultural yields have been increased over the past 100 years is because pesticides that are made from oil and herbicides that are made from oil and natural gas that makes the fertilizer and the oil that makes the tractors run and the trucks run, that will all continue to be available in the quantities and at the prices that it's available today. And that won't necessarily be the case. It almost certainly won't be the case.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Mike Friedman. He's made a new film called Critical Mass, and it's not a pretty picture. Well, several of your interview subjects have been on Radio EcoShock, including Robert Rapier, Bill Rees, Richard Heinberg, and John Michael Greer. But you have Bill Rees, the global footprint guy, and zoologist Desmond Morris, the author of The Naked Ape, talking about population instead of sustainability. Or are they really the same subject?
I don't think it needs to be argued that the number of people alive on the planet is uniquely linked to whether or not the society in which those people live is sustainable. I think the idea that humans exist somehow separate from an impact on nature and the bounds of the laws of physics and inertia and sustainability, I don't need to speak to that more than it has been so far. I avoid using the word sustainability in my day-to-day life because I believe it's wildly overused. I was browsing the internet the other day and I saw a website for a company that was offering sustainable design. So I have no idea what the hell they were selling. And I think it's a wildly overused and washed out term. I think, as Albert Bartlett in his excellent, if chilling, lecture that is viewable for free on YouTube said about population growth, take a 0.1% increase
in human population and extrapolate it indefinitely. And you'll see that it does eventually reach a point where it's unsustainable. Unsustainable in the sense that it cannot be sustained further. So whatever it is, whether it's 5 trillion people eating beans or it's 50 people eating tremendous amounts, you know, consumption and population are, as Bob Engelman from the World Watch Institute says, two sides of the same rectangle. You need both of them to calculate the contents, the volume, the area of that rectangle. Bill Rees and Desmond Morris both are intimately familiar with what we've been through in terms of population growth, and they're also very well-versed in what the future looks like. Both of them are very conscious about environmental matters. In an aside during his interview, Desmond told me that he was present at the original meeting of what eventually became the World Wildlife Fund. And he angered the original founder because he suggested that if they really wanted to conserve the animal species of the planet, that they should put their panda motif on a series of condoms and give them out for free. And that made the guy angry, and then apparently Desmond bumped into him 25 years later, and the guy said, actually, you were right. Now, to be clear, I don't advocate anything remotely control-based in terms of the population picture going forward. I'm not in favor of coercion. I'm not largely, to be honest, in favor of most centralized, dominator, top-down, dictatorial methods of governing societies or groups. And I don't think that application of more exaggerated methods in that vein are going to solve the problems that have largely been created by exactly those methods to begin with. I think that it's evident the population is intimately connected to sustainability. I don't think that a human population that grows indefinitely would be sustainable. I also don't necessarily think that we have a population that will grow indefinitely. But the question is, let's say we level off at 10 or 11 billion. What kind of lifestyle will be sustainable then? And then what about if the numbers begin to decline? What type of society would be sustainable then? One of the great challenges going forward now, as we see playing out the economic crises in Europe and the ongoing stagnation in Japan and in the United States, is that we have a structural political and economic framework to our societies that demands growth, that requires it, because all of our models, all of our methods are predicated on the idea that there's going to be more throughput, more people, more goods, and more consumption year on year. And when that is not present, our economics fails to explain what is happening. And this is exactly what we're seeing around the world right now in those countries that are either experiencing stagnant economic growth or leveled off or decreasing population. So the question is not only, can we increase indefinitely? I don't think we can, and I also don't think we will. And the question isn't, is population at a high level sustainable? A deeper question is, how can we reorganize and redesign our social, political, and economic systems to accurately meet and reflect and fulfill the real needs of human beings? It's too easy to point at a spreadsheet and talk about what growth is and what it does. It's much harder to see human beings as holistic, living creatures that have emotional and psychological needs as well as their physical needs. And this, I think, is one of the great worries in not only the current political and economic sectors, but also in the environmental movement. The environmental movement has traditionally emphasized the kind of the accounting tools of sustainability, how much water use, how much pollution, how much food do we need. But as Calhoun himself said, we need to put the mental back in environmental. You know, humans have deeper needs and a more meaningful purpose in life than merely finding enough rice to eat for the day and having enough water. And so we shouldn't simply think about the bare bones of supplying survival. We need to think about what it will mean to ensure that every person born on this beautiful planet of ours has a full, meaningful life. And that's the real challenge. Whether population is going up, whether it's stabilizing, or whether it's declining, is being willing to reassess and reorganize all of our assumptions, all of our algorithms and spreadsheets, all of our models for planning and molding society based purely on the quality of the life experience for every person alive.
You know, I love what you've just said, and I think my listeners are going to really appreciate it. I have to ask you, in your promo clips, I didn't see anything about that other big threat, global climate disruption. Did you cover that as well?
We don't discuss climate change in the film for several reasons. First of all, because it's such a tremendous topic that we've already covered in so many films by so many different filmmakers that it was really difficult to find something to say. And this led me to the second point, which is that in thinking about how to talk about the interplay between people and the climate, unfortunately, the majority of that discourse is predicated on exactly the type of accounting that I was discussing just now, in the sense that they have calculated how much CO2 a human releases versus any other animal. They've calculated the savings to global CO2 emissions if people have only two children as opposed to three. They've also calculated that contraception is, in a dollar way, better value for money than renewable energy. But all of these things speak to exactly the system of physical material accounting that, as I just mentioned, I don't fully believe accurately represents what humans need or want in life. And the third reason is that I do feel, and this is a personal thing, I do feel that the environmental movement in the past 15 years has become almost wholesale the climate change movement. And I think that that's a real shame, because I think that I don't know old school, because I'm not that old, so I don't know necessarily that it was this way in the past, but the way that environmentalism occurs to me, which is to protect what you see around you from the things that threaten it, is a much more local, community-based approach to stewardship. And we seem now to have global environmental NGOs with corporate mission statements and sponsors, and they have board meetings and the rest of it, and they have expense accounts, and they travel, and they go to symposiums, and they talk to politicians. But on the ground, there's so much to be done to preserve our forests, to preserve our water, to preserve our land, to make sure that the air that we breathe is clean, to make sure that what falls out of the sky isn't laced with something that got put up miles away.
So what do you need now, Mike Friedman, to get this movie out there?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Alex. We've completed the film. We've previewed it at a couple of festivals. The reception has been uniformly positive, which is very encouraging. We've had favorable comments from several very well-placed individuals. And we've had offers of distribution as well for DVD and theatrical in Italy, for DVD in the UK. And we have an offer of a digital partnership here in the US. And I'm also currently on my way to Los Angeles to take a couple more meetings with distributors there. Now, the stumbling block we have is that in the film we use some archive footage, so footage that we sourced from the 1960s, the 1950s, the 1980s, and the companies that supply this footage don't offer it as a pro bono charity service for indie filmmakers, unfortunately. So we're currently running an Indiegogo campaign to raise the money we need to clear the archive footage so that we can begin signing the distribution offers that we have, which will bring the film out in Italy, the UK, and the US, and will allow us the flexibility we need to take advantage of further offers as they arise in other territories. And that Indiegogo campaign is at indiegogo.com/criticalmass, and there's obviously more information on our website, which is criticalmassfilm.com, and we're hoping that we can raise at least $30,000. And if we can do that, I'm in a very strong position to talk to these archive footage guys and get the clearances we need, which only require money. The permission is not a problem. It's the money. And then hopefully we can roll out the film.
And that's not a lot of money. You know, 30,000 of us with a buck each, and you're on your way, and we'll all be a lot smarter. We've been talking with Mike Friedman. His new movie, now in the final stages, getting ready for release, is Critical Mass. Stay tuned at criticalmassfilm.com. Thank you for doing this, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Mother Nature is not going to negotiate, and when we don't have the oil, we're going to be forced to the negotiating table one way or the other.
If what we want to achieve is decline in human civilization in the early to middle decades of the century, we are right on track.
Dr. Calhoun, as a human being, after going through this experiment, what goes through your mind? Are you worried about the future of mankind?
The fact is that population growth ultimately has such a huge impact
that no matter how much I recycle my waste, it isn't going to really affect a planet which sees over 200,000 more people every day. Every day. Someone once said, oh, we go to another planet. Every day you'd have to get 200,000 people into the spaceship to send them off to another planet.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and I want to direct this question to Bill McKibben. A lot of my listeners are in the United States. They're in San Francisco, they're in Florida, they're in New England. Why should they care at all? Why should they be listening to this? Why should they care about what's happening up in northern Canada somewhere?
You know, they don't call it global warming for nothing. This is the first issue we've ever had that really does require the entire world to try and come to terms with something. You know, we can have a long, actually not so much anymore, but there was sort of a debate about, say, whether secondhand smoke was as dangerous as smoking cigarettes yourself or whatever. But there's absolutely no debate about whether secondhand carbon is as dangerous. I mean, you burn tar sands oil in China or you burn it in Alberta, burn it in place else, it has exactly the same effect on the climate. And there are now people in every corner of the world feeling the effects. Where I live in Vermont is as bucolic and beautiful as parts of British Columbia. But last year we had the biggest rainstorm that we've ever had, and it just about tore the place apart. We've lost 500 miles of state highway and 15 bridges, and there were 9 towns cut off from the rest of the town next to mine. They were airdropping food in via helicopter. And, you know, I'm happy to be here tonight, but I confess I've got one eye on the weather report, because there's another monster hurricane now coming up the east coast of the United States, and the ocean temperature off New England is 5 degrees warmer than normal. It's the highest ocean temperatures ever, which means that that hurricane will be able to suck up incredible amounts of moisture. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold, and it'll dump it someplace, if not on Vermont, then on New Hampshire or on New Jersey or on New Brunswick or someplace along that route. And it's a nice idea that we should just take care of our own places, you know. And we should take care of our own places, and we should make them as good as we can and build as solid communities as we can. And we're going to have to, because we have to adapt to that which we can't prevent, you know. We've been busy building much longer bridges in Vermont so they won't wash away next time, and so on and so forth. But remember what I told you about, we've raised temperature 1 degree and we're going to do it 5 degrees unless we stop. You have to adapt to that which you can't prevent, but even more, you've got to prevent that to which no one can adapt. And that's just the place where we are right now. The tar sands, at least the latest data I saw from Jim Hansen, I said, if you could burn all the economically recoverable oil up there, that would be more carbon than humans have yet burned in all the other things that they've burned. There's a lot of stuff. Now, exactly the same thing is true of huge coal mines in Australia and huge fracking fields in the eastern United States and tar sands in Venezuela. It's not the only place in the world we can do this, but we no longer have any margin. We just melted the Arctic, okay? So we've got to stop all these places from going on.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.